appellant's argument in the second case. And you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, Chris Dawes for appellant in this case, Katie Holmes. And so where we left off on the last argument, it's actually a good place to pick up here, because the question is, what was LAK's obligations under its agreement with Katie Holmes? And when you look at the operative language in that agreement, it's contained in Exhibit C, and it states, buyer, of course that's LAK, is responsible for ROW, right-of-way, improvements in the South Taft Avenue and 28th Street Southwest right-of-way area adjacent to the Hine property. And so we have in that contract between KB and Hine an express assumption of that obligation by LAK. Judge Williams in the order below made a point to talk about the fact that the underlying easement agreement and the right-of-way obligations thereunder was something that was open and obvious. It was the subject of discussion and debate between both KB and LAK. The record revealed there was correspondence from LAK's counsel to the title company seeking to remove the underlying easement agreement as an exception to title. That didn't happen. It remained an encumbrance on title. And so you had a very clear assumption of that obligation in the purchase contract.
You say it's clear, and to a certain point it may be clear, but I don't see anything in there that says when they were required to complete.
You're right, Your Honor, that there is no specific timeline that's established in the contract. Although, as Judge Williams suggested during trial, that should have suggested to LAK that its performance was imminent. It was past due, and it had up, and it should have been very concerned about that fact going in. And so in this case, we know that the closing between KB and LAK was in November 2006, and yet we come 2 years later when there are demand letters from the Hine looking for performance from LAK. We still don't have performance. And so certainly to the, given that this the obligation remained unperformed for in excess of 2 years, and frankly remained unperformed up to the time of trial, I think there is a clear breach by LAK in this case. There was some testimony on that timing issue from Mr. Shelton below. His testimony was to the effect that KB had LAK performed in a reasonable manner. KB would have not have suffered any damages. It wouldn't have been sued. It wouldn't have had to defend itself. It wouldn't have had to bring the crosslink against LAK.
But Mr. Shelton's a KB person, right?
Fair enough.
I mean, how can he testify of personal knowledge whether the plaintiffs wouldn't have sued anyway if the improvements had been done 2 years down the road? I mean, you know, their damage theory might have been, had the improvements been done in 05, this would have been a viable project by 08 or 09. It wouldn't matter whether the improvements were done because the market was unable. So, I mean, how is his testimony probative of what the plaintiffs would have done?
Well, I think it's probative because we know what the plaintiffs did do here. They brought suit in 2008 after 2 years had passed since the time LAK undertook that obligation. And had LAK decided to perform in, say, 2009, it would have had a direct impact on the quantum of damages that would have been available. It would have had a direct impact on what was KB's exposure as a result of being exposed to claims by the Hines. Had KB only been in the litigation for 6 months as opposed to 6 years, it would have had a direct impact on what those damages would be. And I do think that's significant. I know that there was a lot of argument at the trial level as to whether LAK had in fact assumed those obligations under the contract. I think some of that is posturing prior to trial, because when LAK representative testified at trial, he was quite candid, acknowledging that in fact LAK had assumed those obligations. And so in my mind, there's no real question as to whether there was, in fact, an effective assumption. When we look at some of the cases we cited in our briefing, and also in the LIK briefing, it's clear there doesn't have to be any magic words used to effectuate that assumption. The court talks about it's not necessary to use any particular language to evidence the grant of the assumption of an obligation. And that, again, that's in the Bayou Land decision. And so in this case, I think when you look at the underlying document and you look at the testimony from the LAK's representative, it's clear that that assumption was taken on. And I don't think that having taken on that, having assumed those liabilities and obligations, it wasn't up to LAK to decide if and when it would perform.
Counsel, are you saying that they were assuming the liabilities for the KB Hine agreement, or did they assume the agreement, the liability under the purchase agreement that was entered into by KB and LAK?
I think under the purchase agreement between KB and LAK, LAK expressly assumed those offset improvement obligations that are set forth in the underlying easement agreement between KB and the Hines.
You say that they expressly assumed. When I was looking through the purchase agreement, I saw that there was reference to a McMillan property in there. And in there it says, upon closing, buyer, which is LAK, will assume the remaining obligations in the McMillan agreement, any payments, and it gives a date when it'll be done by. I didn't see similar kind of express assumption language in this case.
Oh, well, there is not in the body of that agreement. I think that it's certainly amply picked up in Exhibit C, where, again, what's being assumed were those obligations to complete the offsite improvements. But what I would say is there was no express assumption of the entire underlying contract. That wasn't KB's argument at trial. And I think consistent with that, again, is the testimony from the LAK's representative indicating that, in fact, LAK had assumed those obligations and intended to complete those. Now, again, you're back to the issue of what's the timing on that. And I would submit in this case, when you get past 2 years from that original contract, when the original obligation was in default to begin with, you're in breach. LAK was in breach. And as you move further down the track toward that August 2012 trial date, you're certainly further in breach. Again, to look at one other issue, I think when we look at the ruling Judge Williams made on the breach contract claim, by KB against LAK, he seemed to conflate performance under the underlying easement agreement with performance under the purchase and sale agreement between KB and LAK. And again, we look at this in very simple terms. But for LAK's failure to perform, in other words, had LAK performed and completed those offsite improvements in 2006, in 2007, in 2008, or following the original demand letter in 2008 from the Hines, KB wouldn't have found itself in the position it was in terms of having to defend that case.
Isn't that a factual finding? Ultimately, isn't that an express or implied factual finding that we have to defer to the trial court? He rejected the argument. He pointed out that the property valuation was as of 05, that the KB had breached before the assignment to LAK. I mean, isn't there enough in the record that even though we might reach a different conclusion, we still have to stand with the trial court?
I don't think so, because I think as a matter of logic, there's not really any question. Clearly, KB didn't perform as of that November 2005 performance date. There's no real issue on that. But when you look at what's in the record, we look at the obligations that LAK assumed. Had they taken on those obligations and completed them, KB wouldn't have been sued.
That's your conclusion. There's no there's no one with knowledge. There's no expert that said that. There's no plaintiff's representative said that. So why isn't it within the ambit of the lower court's very broad discretion to weigh the findings and reject the position?
Well, clearly the court has broad discretion on factual findings, yeah. But here I think that as a matter of logic, I think it's clear error. I don't think there's any, I think frankly, when you look at the way that opinion is written, there's some confusion as to what the breach in question was and what the real gravamen of KB's complaint was. And Judge Williams did get a little askew talking about the cross claims that had been asserted by LAK against KB, and there were none. So I do think that the court was clearly in an error on that factual determination, and it's clear when you apply a straightforward but-for test, the proximate causation of KB being brought into this case was the fact that LAK didn't perform as it had agreed.
Thank you.
And if I could reserve my remaining time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Can you please support counsel? The operative facts are really not that complicated. KB entered into an agreement with the Hines by which the Hines gave KB certain easements in exchange. KB agreed to install improvements, offsite improvements for the Hines by November 15, 2005. KB breached that agreement by not installing improvements. After KB breached the agreement, KB sold the property to LAK. KB claims that the sale agreement required LAK to install the improvements that KB had not installed, and I will accept that for now, but I'll argue against that later. KB claims that because LAK did not install the improvements, Hines sued KB for breach of contract, which caused KB to incur attorney fees and costs in defending against the breach of contract claim. Okay. Now, what are the trial court's findings on that? The trial court made two related findings. One, and those are at the order regarding cost and attorney fees at page 7. Both based upon the trial court's conclusion that KB did assume the responsibility to construct the improvements. While LAK had not installed the improvements, KB's failure to install the improvements by November 15, 2005 was not tied in any way to action or inaction by LAK. That's finding number one. Finding number two was KB failed to prove it was sued because LAK did not install the improvements. Rather, the evidence showed that KB was sued for its own prior breach. That's finding number two. So even though KB argues that this should be a de novo review, those are factual findings, and the standard is clearly erroneous. So now we have to look at the record to say, okay, is there sufficient evidence to support the trial court's conclusion? First, we need to look at what was the breach at issue at trial. Well, the breach at issue at trial, if you look at the complaint, was KB's breach by failing to install the improvements by November 15, 2005. That was the stipulated date of damages. That was what was tried in the trial court. We didn't talk about some future date where LAK was supposed to put in the improvements in 2007, 2008, 2009 and determine damages by that date. The damages that were being determined on that breach of contract was November 15, 2005. And the judge would have pointed out that was an important factual finding for the court because that was the issue, that was the breach. Now, with regard to sufficient evidence, I would suggest look at the complaint and you will see that KB was sued for its own breach of its agreement with the Hines. Matter of fact, KB admits at page 5 of its reply that it was sued for its own breach of its agreement with the Hines. So there was sufficient evidence for the trial court to find that LAK did not cause KB to breach its agreement with the Hines. This is not a situation where you had a continuing performance going on and the performance date had not yet occurred. So then KB can say, well, we were looking to LAK to perform this work, and had LAK not performed the work, we would have done it. And we would have been able to do it by the time of the performance date, and we would not have breached our agreement. Therefore, you caused us to breach our agreement. This is a situation where KB had already breached the agreement. There was no evidence that KB would have done anything different but for LAK. It had already breached the agreement. There wasn't even any evidence that KB was going to put in the improvements at some future time after November 15, 2005.
Was there any evidence that the plaintiffs would not have gone ahead with the lawsuit had LAK put the improvements in?
No. It was not discussed, Your Honor. And I, along that line, as you pointed out, there was no testimony, there was no evidence of what would have happened if KB had installed the improvements on November 15, 2006, or 2007, or 2008, or if LAK had done it. So with regard to that assumption then LAK could not have assumed KB's obligation to the Hines, because that was in the past. That was gone. All LAK could do is install the improvements at some point in time in the future, or assume obligations to install improvements at some point in time in the future. So I would suggest that there is more than sufficient evidence for this court to find that the trial court's findings that LAK did not cause the damages that KB sought and did not cause KB to breach its agreement with the Hines are supported by the evidence. Now, what the trial court then did, and what you would naturally do, is say, okay, what KB really wants and what they're claiming in this breach of contract theory is indemnification. They want to be indemnified because of their prior breach. And so he looked in the agreement to see whether there was an indemnification clause, and he found that there were indemnification clauses, for example, with the McMillan there were other situations where there were indemnification, but not in this instance. And so he said, you failed to prove your evidence, there's no indemnification clause, you're not entitled to any attorney fees. Now, the reason I cited the Rocky Mount Festival v. Parsons case in my brief is because it seems to me that really what we're talking about here is what the law calls the wrong of another doctrine. And even though it's couched as a breach of contract, it really is a situation where you're saying, okay, I was sued because you breached a duty to me. And because you breached that duty to me, I ended up in a lawsuit. My damages are the attorney fees I incurred in that lawsuit. That's the classic wrong of another doctrine discussed in the Parsons case. And if you look at that decision, the Supreme Court talks about the distinct core of facts there's a requirement that when two parties are suing in the same action, that the plaintiff is suing one of the defendants based upon a distinct core of facts and premised on different legal theories in order to recover. And the significance of that distinction is, and you read the decision, is there's this rule that sits out there that says that when you have joint tortfeasors, one joint tortfeasor cannot recover fees and costs against the other because they're suing for their own actions, not a distinct or separate action. So the Supreme Court in Parsons said, we're not going to overrule our decision in Bakker v. Western Insurance Company, which is a 1986 decision, and we recognize that rule exists. Joint tortfeasors, no. You cannot recover fees and costs. But if you are sued on a distinct core of facts and premise on distinct legal theories, so that you're not a joint tortfeasor on that issue, then you can recover under the classic wrong of another doctrine. And that's why I brought that up in brief and discussed that issue. Because I think that here, as the court said, and here's another factual finding that would be applicable to the clearly erroneous standard, the court found that KB remained liable under its agreement with the Hines, and LAK, by entering into the purchase and sale agreement, became jointly liable with KB to install the improvements. So, joint liability, what did we talk about at the trial court level? Same improvements, same legal theories, everything was identical. We were, in essence, just as the court said, found jointly liable. So, under the wrong of another doctrine, KB could not recover there. So, they can't recover under the contract because they didn't prove that any breach caused KB to suffer any damages. They don't have an indemnification clause. They can't recover under the wrong of another doctrine. So now I want to address briefly this issue of alternative argument that we would contend. You don't have to go this far, but if you're going to address that issue, is we do not believe that LAK ever assumed the past due obligation of KB. And I cited to the Bayou Land Company Vitale case that says that just because you purchase property that is subject to an obligation does not make you subject to, does not cause you to assume that obligation. There has to be an express assumption agreement. What KB cites to is Exhibit C as its assumption agreement. And the real problem I have with Exhibit C is that Exhibit C is that. It is an exhibit. And if you look at the clause in the contract that references Exhibit C, it's talking about disclosure obligations. So if you read the clause in the contract that says that we hereby disclose to you that the following improvements have been completed and the following improvements remain to be completed, and you need to go out and confirm it. And then Exhibit C lists those improvements, and then you get this language in Exhibit C that talks about responsibility, and suddenly Exhibit C becomes an operative clause in and of itself, even though it's not in the contract. We believe that the law says that you have to interpret Exhibit C in light of the language in the contract itself. And when you do that, you see that all it's talking about is that these improvements have not been completed. You need to complete those improvements if you want. These improvements we've already completed. You're accepting that you're buying a property without these improvements being completed. Now, with regard to Mr. McQuinney's testimony at trial that Mr. Giles cited you to, he pretty much said the same thing. We agreed that we needed to put in these improvements. If you're going to develop this property, Loveland is going to require you to put in these improvements. We can't look back to KB to put in the improvements. We have to put in the improvements. Why is there no date, Judge Roman? There's no date because it's not an assumption clause. If it were an assumption clause, you would have a clause in there that says, you need to put in the improvements by a specific date. And why would that date be in there? Because KB would have gone back to the Hines and negotiated an extension of the date of performance. But none of that was done. And none of it was done because it's not an assumption clause. It's just an exhibit. Now, I also addressed the issue, and I won't take a lot of time because it's a complicated issue, and I think I addressed it well in the brief, of a covenant running with the land. And I bring that up now because if you look at the complaint actually alleges liability against LAK based upon the covenant running with the land. And the theory was that because if you look at the agreement between Hines and KB, it has language in there that says this obligation to install these improvements runs with the land. But what happens when you breach that covenant as a matter of law, and we'll have to go back to some very old cases, those are the only cases I can cite. I realize they're very old cases that I cited. But the law has always been that when a covenant runs with the land and that covenant is breached and is not a continuing covenant, then it becomes a personal obligation and no longer runs with the land. And that is that was one of the reasons why we argued that we could not be liable to the Hines because that covenant had been breached and we had no personal obligation to the Hines. So then, because the trial court's finding is supported by the evidence, because there is no indemnification clause, and because if you look at that Exhibit C, and I think you can review that de novo because it's not based on interpretation of evidence, it's just what was there. It's not an assumption clause. So there was really no assumption liability. KB failed to prove that LAK caused it any damages. And that is what the trial court found, and we would ask this court to affirm that decision. We would also ask the court to, we could have argued that we were the prevailing party. We didn't argue we were the prevailing party. We didn't argue it on appeal. We accept the trial court's finding that neither party was the prevailing party. Between KB and LAK, the amount of the attorney fees that was awarded to KB. We think the trial court had good reasons for the decisions it made. Maybe it didn't artfully state it in terms of talking about a cross-claim against LAK, which did not exist. But if you look at, the trial court certainly could, within its discretion, adjust the attorney fees to reflect the fact that you have two defendants and one plaintiff, and that there was a new attorney coming in, and the prior attorney had basically not been as efficient as they could have been in trying the case, and the counsel that came in had multiple attorneys in the case. I think there was evidence to support the trial court's decision in the determination of costs and fees and awarded as well. And I thank you for your time.
But before this court, you're asking for appellate fees.
Yes. As we said in our brief, we do at request appellate fees under the cost shifting provision in the purchase sale agreement between KB and LAK. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to talk briefly again about this notion of whether the underlying offsite improvement obligations were assumed by LAK. The notion that somehow there's not an effective assumption because the operative language is in an exhibit to the contract doesn't have any basis. It's every exhibit C is every bit as much a part of the contract as any other paragraph in the body of the contract. And so that's a legally effective assumption provision. Again, I think it's critical. I think that it's good lawyer argument, but the fact is LAK's representative knew and acknowledged that those obligations had been assumed by LAK. The exact testimony that we have in our brief, and I'll say it very briefly, was...
Well, I think we know what the testimony is, but unless the contract is ambiguous, what does his testimony have to do with it?
Well, and I don't disagree. I think I've heard hints, although it wasn't exactly argued below or here, that somehow there was ambiguity. To me, the language of Exhibit C is quite clear as to that assumption. I don't think there's any issue about that, and I think the testimony from LAK's representative just confirms that.
And then nobody argued ambiguity below.
That was, I don't believe ambiguity was argued below. I don't believe that was the case. So there was also argument from Mr. Goddard that, you know, what was tried in the case was whether there was a damages flowing from breach of that underlying contract, that easement agreement. And certainly that was a central part of the case. But equally significant in the case was the separate and independent breach of the LAK-KB contract, because LAK didn't perform. So that was a separate and distinct breach. And again, I don't want to repeat myself, but again, when you look at a but-for standard, had LAK gone ahead and performed under the purchase agreement with KB, KB wouldn't have been facing those claims. And if you look at the record, Exhibit L1 is correspondence in October 2008, before the time suit was filed. And that was the Heinz looking for performance as late as 2008. And again, had that performance gone through, KB wouldn't have found itself in the crosshairs of litigation. And that exhibit L1 is at the CD at 1246 is the record site. So again, I think there's ample evidence in the record to support the notion that but for LAK's breach, KB wouldn't have faced litigation. There's also argument from LAK regarding the wrong of another doctrine. I would submit the wrong of another doctrine is really not even in play here. Our claims were based on the contract provisions. Our damages were separate and distinct from the underlying damages sought by the Heinz in this case. The Heinz were looking for a differential in value based on the improvements not having been made. The damages sought by KB in this case really were its litigation expense in this case. So I think you got separate and independent breaches. Those wrong of another cases typically deal with concepts of joint tortfeasors. This isn't a joint tortfeasor scenario. It's really a question of separate independent contracts. and there was an independent contractual duty owed from LAK to KB, simply wasn't performed. I'd like to turn briefly to the issue of attorney's fees and costs. In our estimation, the court did not make ample findings to support the reductions that were made as to the award of fees and costs in favor of KB. Mr. Goddard made reference to my predecessor counsel, who maybe wasn't as effective and as efficient. It would be the case, I would tell this court, we made an ample provision for that and substantially discounting the amount even requested in our fee application to Judge Williams. So our belief is it's appropriate, given the lack of findings and the arbitrary nature of some of those reductions, it's appropriate for that issue to be remanded to Judge Williams or to the trial court to determine those issues. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel on this aspect of the case. Our counselor excused. The case stands submitted, and we will issue a written opinion in due course.